Well, welcome once again to another Throttle Up Radio Show and Podcast, and I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, and I am glad to be here. And thank you for listening. I guess I should say up front what we are. Okay, so we're a radio show on Red State Talk Radio on the weekends, weekend show. And then we are a podcast. Our podcast is covered by most podcast platforms, or is on most podcast platforms. And we have a website, right? You know, throttleupradio.com. Yep. And it's there. All of our podcasts are there. How many years do we have worth? So since 2016 is when we started this this initiative, right? So it's been so we have a whole library of stuff, and so you know, and some of the how would you classify the this confluence of ideas? It's out of the box, right? All out of the box ideas. Critical thinking. We also talk about complex problem solving and stuff like that. Why? Well, because we need to be able to think critically, and we need to do it better. Why? Well, look around you. Do you think things are going swimmingly in the world? That's the big question. The answer would be you know, unless you have just come in from another planet, the answer would be, well, no, things are not going swimmingly. We have a lot of problems, a lot of issues we're dealing with, a lot of disagreements and a lot of hostility going back and forth with respect to human existence and so forth and so on. We are here. Attempting to clear the air, attempting to point us in the right direction so that we can actually prosper. We can, how does it go in the Declaration of Independence? Does it, what are the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? Yeah. So that's what we're looking for, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Can we do that and prosper? Yes, we can. Okay, so that's what we are all about. I did mention that the podcast is available on all podcast platforms that we know of. That's a good way to listen to this because you can stop it anytime you want and then pick it up again at a later time. All right, so we're going to start this show. Now, we've been doing a long series of shows. The overarching title of the shows that we're doing right now is Think Like a Fighter Pilot. The reason why we're doing that ought to be obvious because of the popularity of the Top Gun Maverick movie, as well as other stuff that is going on that relates to that. There's a whole bunch of stuff on YouTube, for example, that deals with that general category of ideas, that general category of activities that humans engage in, kind of a very unusual activity. Humans, only recently, if you look at the course of human events, and human history, only recently have humans been able to actually fly. And we have also recently been able to fly very, very fast and pull high Gs and do all kinds of stuff in the air, including aerial combat. I happen to be an expert in the area of aerial combat. That's one of my areas of expertise. Not the only one, by the way, but it's one of my key areas of expertise. I was a expert in that field. There's also terms that are used to describe that. I will use them in the, I'll try to use some of the common terms that are being employed right now. Top Gun is a common term, What exactly does that mean? That means basically that you're trained, or you are an expert, or you are an instructor in the art and science of aerial combat. That's basically what it means. That was one of my areas of expertise. All right, so what are we doing on this week? We're going to start off this show with a question from my great audio engineer, and she's here every week to help me out, does a great job. She also does the post-production stuff. There's quite a bit of stuff there, and she works directly with the radio station as well to deal with all of the technical and organizational issues relating to this radio show and podcast. Here is the question from my audio engineer.
Hello, Kevin, and hello to your listening audience. Okay, you are proposing a radical idea. Remove your currently installed intellectual equipment that is faulty and replace it with new and different intellectual equipment that will work. Can you explain this for your listening audience?
Yes, I can. Again, great question. I will do my very best to explain this. First and foremost, yes, it is a radical idea, but this is what we are all about anyway. This is not common ground that we are on. We are on new ground. We have plowed new ground. We are all about critical thinking and the related subject, or the subjects related to such a thing that we do with our mental energy, or our mental capacity, or our brains, if you will, or our consciousness. We want to be able to think well, and the most common term that kind of embraces that is critical thinking. So we want to think critically, of course. Do we have the capacity to do so? Now, one of the things that is often missing in this discussion are what needs to be put in place that will provide us with the ability to think critically, and I might also add to perform complex problem solving, but that's all part of it as well, so don't get too confused about that. We're going to more or less stick with the term critical thinking, or thinking critically, but just keep in mind that it does embrace the other key aspects of our mental energy that deals with identifying or clarifying what the problem is, solving the problem effectively, getting on with our mission, if you will. We are talking about purposeful activities here. Just keep that in mind. Primarily, what we are dealing with here is we are dealing with people that are engaged in high-stakes operations. So if you are, in fact, engaged in or will become engaged in some kind of a high-stakes operation, then this is the radio show and podcast for you. Plain and simple. This is your go-to place for help or guidance or performance aids in that area of human activity. Keep in mind that most studies that have been done about human psychology have not been done when have not been done to or dealing with people, humans, professionals that were in fact engaged in a high stakes operation. We are different in that regard. Okay, this show and the work that I do is different in that first and foremost we're dealing with that portion of human activity or human endeavor, which is high stakes operations. And what exactly does that mean? Well, let me give you an example. All right, the example is the Top Gun Maverick movie. All right, so they were training for a high stakes operation. The whole point of the movie, the whole point of going back to Top Gun that Maverick did, the whole point of putting together a Tiger team, the whole point of that was they were engaged in a planning and preparation and training for the execution of a high-stakes operation. High-stakes operation basically means that human life is on the line. Often, the survivability of the organization. In this case, human life was on the line. We could also argue that in this case, the national defense was on the line, certainly. I have been involved in that in my life, in my military career. I was doing things in which national defense was on the line. Excuse me. And also, human life was on the line, so I was involved in a lot of high-stakes operations. And in preparing for it and actually doing a high-stakes operation, it required us to reconsider, excuse me, reconsider what is it that we need to put in place that is part of our intellectual equipment. Okay. The question is, remove our currently installed intellectual equipment. Now, I'm making the assumption here that we're dealing with a product of our society, product of our educational and training system. Okay. So we were born as human beings, but we had to go through some kind of a training process. Some of it was formal training and education. Other parts of it was our training and education is faulty. I'm going to come right out and say that right now. Our training and educational system is faulty. It does not provide us with that which is necessary for us to achieve mission success. What is our mission? Well, our personal mission ought to be prosperity for all. Our personal mission ought to be safety, security, and prosperity, and also the blessings of liberty. What is our mission? Our mission is part of this great country of ours, part of Americans. We ought to be promoting prosperity for everyone and embracing the idea of doing that which will give us the benefits of liberty, so that we can pursue happiness. Okay, that's the general idea. In my case, the mission success was also the specific mission, which was considered to be essential or vital. Okay, so my mission was not trivial. My mission and operation was vital to, in many cases, it was vital to the national defense. When I retired from the military and went into commercial aviation, my mission was vital to the survivability of, or the viability and survivability of, the enterprise in which I was working with. Okay, so that was that's our mission, and so here we have a high stakes operation. That's what's being conducted, right? So why is the equipment wrong or faulty that we currently have? Okay, and the reason for this is the following. The equipment that we have been given emphasizes decomposition of reality into its constituent parts. Okay? What does that mean? It means that our understanding of analysis is based upon the following fundamental idea. Now, this is not just coming from me. This is coming from other great thinkers, and I'm not putting myself in that same category, of course, but other great thinkers out there. Bertal Anfi is one of them, who is the father of general systems theory. And his proposition was what I'm going to explain as well. Our idea is reductionism. Okay, it's based on the idea of reductionism. All right. Where did that come from? I don't actually know where it came from, but reductionism and the decomposition of part of whatever it is into its constituent parts, and that is based upon the idea that if we know the constituent parts of something, in other words, if we know the parts and components of a thing, then we know the thing and what the thing does. Okay, and to that extent, we believe in the idea of determinism, which means that the world actually can be determined precisely. Reality can be determined. It's another term that has been used is a clockwork universe. Given our advancements in the field of science and mathematics, we then have the ability to understand reality in terms of a clockwork universe, which means that everything can be precisely determined and everything can be precisely understood. And we can determine the outcome of existence, or we can project into the future accurately and deterministically. That is the intellectual equipment that we have been given. And we have been taught that determinism can be achieved through the course of utilizing deterministic types of mathematical processes. Okay, the other way of saying that is that we can achieve certitude. We can be absolutely certain about everything. Okay, that is the intellectual equipment that we have been given. We have been led to believe that this is, in fact, our reality, and this is, in fact, our capability. So, if we decompose something into its constituent parts and examine each component individually, and then we add those components up in a linear fashion, then we can understand reality. We can understand the whole object, the whole system, the whole phenomena, the whole creature. We can understand it. That is the intellectual equipment that we have been given, results in that level of comprehension. Unfortunately, and now hang on to your hats here, because this is not something that you're going to get in a lot of places. But the reason why you're listening to this radio show and podcast is because we don't think in a conventional way. We are way outside the box. So hang on to your hat. The intellectual equipment that we have installed right now that leads us to that aspect of, or that thinking process that I call literal or deterministic literalism, is actually faulty. Why is that? Because the world is not completely understood. The reality is complex and uncertain. So in the real world, in the real existence, we are dealing with, or we are immersed in a reality, an environment in which complexity and uncertainty prevail. Okay, that is a given. So it is our equipment that we have installed. Is it capable of dealing with that aspect of reality, which is complexity and uncertainty prevail? The answer is almost certainly no. Our equipment cannot deal with that because our equipment has been built upon a different model of reality, one in which certitude is achievable. Okay, we can decompose. The reductionism is the way to go. And linearity is the way to go. All of this stuff that we have been given actually doesn't work in the reality that we find ourselves in. When we are engaged in a high-stakes operation, we have to deal with some things that are not completely certain or cannot be determined exactly or it is impossible for us to actually achieve certitude in every single case, so that we have to be able to function under conditions of complexity and uncertainty and still achieve mission success, or another way of saying that is to still have a high probability that we are going or can achieve mission success. Okay, so what is it that we have to install? All right, first and foremost, we have to get rid of all of this stuff that we have in place in our mind space. We have to just get rid of it. Or another way of saying that, perhaps less dramatically, is that we have to kind of set it aside. Okay, so we have to put it somewhere on the shelf and say, okay, this is great. So this is a display shelf that we have in our you know, in our mind space. So we have this display shelf, and we say, okay, this stuff, yeah, you know, it's something that we have been given. Some of it works pretty well in certain circumstances, but it's kind of limited in its scope, breadth and depth, and stuff like that. It really doesn't work in the real world, but it's kind of interesting, and it's a curiosity. So we're going to put it on the shelf, right? We're going to know it's there. It's on the shelf. Can we use it? Well, sometimes we can, sure. We can pull it down and use it, but not during high-stakes operations. We kind of not want to do that. We want to employ different kinds of intellectual equipment that's better suited. Okay, the other way, I've often said this, is your thinking stress tested, right? So that's the big question here. Now, we stress test wings on airplanes, and we stress test all kinds of things. Okay, we stress test electronic equipment. We see how much heat it can deal with, and how do we dissipate excess heat and all kinds of things. So stress testing is not unusual, but let us stress test our intellect. Okay, is our thinking process, or is the intellectual equipment that we have installed in our mind space stress tested? And the answer is probably no. Okay, so let's just say that it has not been. It may work, but we're not certain it's going to work under high stakes operations or under stressful conditions. We're just not going to. We don't know. All right. So if the equipment is not stress tested, then let's put it on the shelf and let's say, okay, that's fine, and let's go ahead and acquire the intellectual equipment that is in fact going to work under high stakes operations and is going to work under conditions of complexity and uncertainty. Okay? That's what we need to deal with. What is it that enables us to perform well under conditions of complexity and uncertainty? What actually is it? Okay. Now, I put some labels on it, but there are other labels as well. But one of the things that we have to clear up, the confusion that is out there. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of so-called experts that are coming into this arena and doling out advice. We are never short of expert advice. I mean, that is prevalent, that is always with us. Most of that stuff sounds good, but it actually doesn't work. Okay. I would be very cautious about expert advice. What I would say is that first and foremost, you have to go out and you have to search the landscape, and you have to identify that which is going to enable you to perform well under conditions of complexity and uncertainty. Okay. Whatever you do, you have to install intellectual equipment that will work under complexity and uncertainty. Plug that stuff in to your power socket. That's what you do. I will add a couple of other things. under conditions of complexity uncertainty, I will add one other thing that was brought out, revealed in the Top Gun Maverick movie. Also, I have talked about this quite extensively in my Substack series of articles. You can go to Substack and find them. They're listed under the heading of velocity. Okay, I've added one other thing, and that happens to be time compression. All right. So if we are engaged in a high-stakes operation in which we are dealing with a large-scale dynamic system, then we have to address one other thing as well, which is time compression. What exactly is time compression? We talked about this before, but just as a refresher, and this is pretty important, right? Time compression means that we are moving through time and space at a relatively high velocity, which causes the emergence of this rather important phenomena that we call time compression. Time compression is that the time available to perform some kind of activity or task is less than the time required. Okay, so we have to compress, we have to deal with the challenge of time compression, and we have to reorder the way we approach our mental and physical activities such that it actually can be done during the time in which the time horizon becomes compressed, which is the time available is less than it normally would be. Okay, so I'll give you a graphic example. So if we have the time horizon, and let's say that we want to engage in activity A, right? And activity A takes you from T1 all the way to T2. Okay, and T1 to T2, we can measure that in terms of how many minutes and how many seconds that it takes, all right? So if the time required is T1 to T2, but the time available is less than the time required, right? So the time available fits within that, but it's less than, so we have to do some kind of, we have to deal with time compression in a way that enables us to actually complete the activity under those time-compressed conditions. How in the world do we do such a thing? We do it by installing different kinds of intellectual equipment. What does this equipment do? All right, first and foremost, this equipment operates in a different dimension. Now you think that I've lost my mind. I know that. Okay, fine. That comes with the territory. I have not lost my mind. Kind of sounds like I have, but I haven't. I have not lost my mind. The equipment that I'm talking about operates in a different dimension. What exactly does that mean? It's not something that is brand new. This idea has been around for a very, very long period of time, but it's often been neglected, which is our intellectual equipment operates at the conceptual level, not at the literal level. Once you go from the literal to the conceptual, you can function under conditions of increased time compression in which complexity and uncertainty prevail. So what is it? It is, in fact, that which enables us to conceptualize. Okay, so where does that fit into our intellectual equipment? All right, so I'll tell you exactly where it fits. All right, our intellectual equipment is such that enables us to first and foremost to achieve situational awareness. We have to be aware of the situation, and it has to be accurate. It cannot be partial awareness. We need total awareness of the situation. My audio engineer is giving me, I got one more minute before we play it. Is that right? Okay, so my great aunt, she's keeping me on track. I wander off. All right, so the intellectual equipment is that which will enable us to consider reality in terms of its conceptual nature. Another way of saying that is that we are then able, capable, willing, and proficient at creating conceptual structures. Our reality is based upon our ability to understand it in terms of the conceptual structure that is representative of the reality that we have encountered. So we look at reality not literally. We look at reality from a conceptual standpoint. Now, I want to move on to this great audio clip from the Academy of Ideas that relates to what we're talking about. A little bit different perspective, but that's okay because that's all part of Throttle Up Radio Show and podcast. We do that. All right, so let's listen to this great audio clip from the Academy of Ideas, and the name of it is Why the Lack of Religion Breeds Mental Illness. Here we go.
The least of all things with a meaning is worth more in life than the greatest of things without it. We live in a world consumed by an endless series of crises. But of all the crises we face, the one that may be of the greatest concern is one that receives relatively little attention, and this is the crisis of meaning. In his essay, The Aims of Psychotherapy, Carl Jung called this the general neurosis of our times, and as he explains further, the lack of meaning in life is a soul sickness whose full extent and import our age has not yet begun to comprehend. This crisis reaches back several generations. In the late 19th century, the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche observed that nihilism, or what he termed the radical repudiation of meaning, was on the rise in the West. Was this the result of the fall of the Christian worldview and the rise of a scientific, reductionist, and mechanistic worldview? Was the death of God the most momentous event of the modern era? Nietzsche, writes Walter Kaufmann, felt the agony, the suffering, and the misery of a godless world so intensely, at a time when others were yet blind to its tremendous consequence, that he was able to experience in advance, as it were, the fate of a coming generation. We are now experiencing the fate that Nietzsche prophesied, a fate where, in the words of Viktor Frankl, ever more people have the means to live, but no meaning to live for, a fate which is manifesting in a hatred of the existing society, the apocalyptic sense of an ending, and the need for some kind of worthy cause to give meaning to one's life. In this video, we are going to explore what meaning in life is and why it is so important. We will then examine why the decline in religion may be the prime cause of this modern crisis of meaning and a prime factor in the widespread occurrence of anxiety disorders, neuroses, and depression. Happiness, writes Ian McGilchrist, is about the present moment, independent of other moments, whereas meaning links events across time, thus integrating past, present, and future. Meaning in a human life is grounded in narrative. A life narrative is the story we tell ourselves about ourselves, and this story acts as a sort of cognitive organizing process that helps us make sense of who we are and where we are going. Our narrative gives rise to and sustains our sense of self, and just like a novel or movie, it is defined by a particular plot or theme. This theme can be coherent and life-affirming, or it can be disjointed, disempowering, incoherent, and so lacking in meaning. The less meaning our life has, the more we will suffer, and this is exemplified by the experience of many schizophrenics who struggle to view life through the coherence of a narrative. In Madness and Modernism, Lewis Sass quotes a schizophrenic patient who said, "I feel as if I've lost the continuity linking the events in my past. Instead of a series of events linked by continuity, My past just seems like disconnected fragments. And as McGilchrist explains concerning this disturbing lack of a coherent life narrative, if your world disintegrates through a lack of narrative, you stop seeing anything in context, and it becomes puzzling, even frightening. Its sheer facticity then stands out, since it can no longer take its place in any world schema of other things and people that would give it meaning. While most people do not suffer the disintegrating effect of no life narrative, what many lack is a satisfying narrative that is rich in meaning. A narrative, in other words, that creates fulfillment and enables one to cope with the existential conditions of life. The great prevalence of anxiety disorders, depression, addictions, and psychotropic and illicit drug use is evidence which points to this dire lack of meaning, and as Jung notes, meaninglessness inhibits fullness of life and is therefore equivalent to illness. To make matters worse, while many people feel that their life is missing something, most do not realize that what is missing is meaning. Instead, to fill this void of meaninglessness, many people chase after more money and material goods, elevated social status, increased knowledge, or most of all, moments of pleasure and happiness. But none of these things are adequate replacements for, as McGilchrist explains, people who report being happy but have little or no sense of meaning in their lives have the same gene expression patterns as people who are enduring chronic adversity, such as loneliness, bereavement, or poverty. Given the importance of meaning, how can a life lacking it be infused with it? How, in other words, can we discover a more meaningful life narrative? While there are many practical steps to move us in this direction, from finding a life purpose, to cultivating interpersonal relationships, to confronting life's challenges, one of the most effective is to tap into the wisdom embedded in the mythos of the great religions. What is the use of a religion without a mythos, asks Jung, since religion means, if anything at all, precisely that function which links us back to the eternal myth. Mythos, or what is more commonly called myth or mythology, contains truths about the human predicament and the nature of the psyche that are expressed in narrative form. These narratives can be used to augment our own personal narrative with rich threads of meaning, as they provide insights for how to cope with elements of the human condition, be it freedom, loss, loneliness, sickness, old age, suffering, or death. In the modern day, many of us have relegated myth to the realm of fiction, believing that only reason, logic, and science, or what is called the domain of logos, can reveal to us the truths of the world. But as Jung writes, myth is not fiction. It consists of facts that are continually repeated and can be observed over and over again. Both logos and mythos are realms for discovering truth, but the truths they reveal are of a different nature. Science teaches us the neurological correlates behind the phenomenon of pain. Mythos teaches us how to meaningfully endure pain. Science teaches us how to cure a sickness. Mythos teaches us how to meaningfully cope with loss and death. Or as Karen Armstrong explains, logos, or reason, is the pragmatic mode of thought that enables people to function effectively in the world. People have always needed logos to make an efficient weapon, organize their societies, or plan an expedition. Logos is continually on the lookout for new ways of controlling the environment and is essential to the survival of our species. But logos has its limitations. Good at manipulating the world and making us powerful, it does not contribute to any broader understanding of the meaning of our lives. For that, people turn to mythos. We can gain exposure to the realm of mythos through great works of literature, be it those of Dostoevsky, Shakespeare, or Cervantes. But the great religions are the ultimate source of this wisdom. For the primary purpose of religion, from time immemorial, has been to help us cope with our existential predicament and to find meaning in life, even if this purpose has at times been corrupted by religion in its organized and institutional forms. Not only Christianity with its symbols of salvation, writes Jung, but all religions, including the primitive with their magical rituals, are forms of psychotherapy which treat and heal the suffering of the soul and the suffering of the body caused by the soul. And in a speech given to a group of psychotherapists in the 1930s, he further explains, "It is not a play on words when I call religion a psychotherapeutic system. It is the most elaborate system, and there's a great practical truth behind it. As an example of how one can put the mythos of religion to use, Jung explores the symbolic notion of the imitation of Christ. Is not Jesus, he asks, a prototype of those who, trusting their inner experience, have gone their individual ways in defiance of the world? The imitation of Christ is the notion that Jesus' life should be used as a template for how to live. According to St. Augustine, emulating Christ was the fundamental purpose in the life of a good Christian. But as Jung explains, the traditional interpretation of the imitation of Christ, as counseling that we strive to live as Christ did, has this disadvantage. In the long run, we worship, as a divine example, a man who embodied the deepest meaning of life, and then, out of sheer imitation, we forget to make real our own deepest meaning, self-realization. Jung suggests that the imitation of Christ should be interpreted in a symbolic manner as the call to go our own way and to strive to develop ourselves as fully as is humanly possible. For Jung saw Christ as an example of someone who actualized himself completely and who was unafraid to follow his conscience, even if it ended in his persecution. Christ, in other words, was an example of a heroic personality. The imitation of Christ, explains Jung, might well be understood in a deeper sense. It could be taken as the duty to realize one's deepest conviction with the same courage and the same self-sacrifice shown by Jesus. The imitation of Christ is but one example in the deep well of practical wisdom embedded in the great religions. And to profit from this wisdom, we do not need to become a follower of an organized religion, nor must we pledge allegiance to any specific sect or creed. For as many organized religions are corrupted by power and degraded by politics, they can be barriers to accessing the authentic truths of religion. Fortunately, profiting from the truths of the great religions can be accomplished through a personal effort. Reading the texts, learning about the various rituals embedded in the mythology, and most importantly, putting into practice what we learn can give rise to a religious outlook on life. Or as Karen Armstrong explains, the only way to assess the value and truth of any myth is to act upon it. The myth of the hero, for example, which takes the same form in nearly all cultural traditions, showed us how to live more richly and intensely, how to cope with our mortality, and how creatively to endure the suffering that flesh is heir to. But if we failed to apply it to our situation, a myth would remain abstract and incredible. For the truths of religion to impact our life, we do not need to fully understand their meaning. For myths, like dreams, are encoded in symbolic form, and so they point in the direction of truths that are not fully comprehensible by the conscious intellect. But as Jung explains, we like to imagine that something which we do not understand does not help us in any way. But that is not always so. Myths have a direct effect on the unconscious, no matter whether it is understood or not. The fact that its repeated telling has not long since become obsolete can, I believe, be explained by its usefulness. In the modern world, many of us have completely severed our connection to the realm of mythos, and many of us view religion with derision and scorn. Some consider this as a sign of enlightenment and progress, but it may be a form of psychological regression. In a lecture delivered to Yale University in 1937 titled Psychology and Religion, Jung went as far as to call atheism the urban neurosis, and in his decades of practice treating hundreds of patients, he came to the conclusion that for some patients the only means of fixing what ailed them was the birth of a religious attitude to life. Among those in the second half of life, he wrote, that is to say, over 35, there has not been one whose problem in the last resort was not that of finding a religious outlook on life. If we continue to spurn religion, we will not lose our need for meaning. We will merely look for meaning in other places. We will worship the state, a political party, or science, all of which are inadequate and sometimes dangerous substitutes to the cultivation of an authentic religious outlook on life. Perhaps, therefore, we need the mythos of religion to nourish our psyche and imbue our life with meaning and purpose. Perhaps without some form of a religious outlook, man descends into the chaos of nihilism, totalitarianism, and hatred of self and society. And for those who think science has done away with our need for religion, Jung poses the following question. Can science be so sure that there is no such thing as a religious instinct? Become a supporting member and access 12 courses in...
Okay, what I would like to consider as well, along with this great piece by the Academy of Ideas, is this. My proposition is that we have to consider that which enables us to think at the conceptual level, to view reality in terms of its conceptual structure. If we are, in fact, going to explore or to embrace the conceptual, then we have to also consider such things as myth and religion, or the religious attitude to life. And what does that mean? It means that there is, in fact, conscious energy that we can tap into. The world, reality, is not just a collection of random parts. There is meaning to it. There's meaning to our life. And we need to be able to consider such a thing and tap into it. How much time do I have left? I have 30 seconds left. My great audio engineer is keeping me on track. I tend to wander. All right, so the bottom line for this show is to stop thinking literally all the time. And when engaged in high-stakes operations in which complexity and uncertainty prevail, and under conditions of increased time compression, you must think conceptually. Think conceptually for your life's mission as well. Thank you for listening. See you all next week.